This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
So this is the freshly picked coffee cherry. I'm going to put some down here and you can watch how it's pulped. Yep, keep turning it.
Come along and join me at Kona Historical Society's Kona Coffee Living History Farm for a walking tour with Gavin Mikulka and a conversation with Ryan Nakata.
Here in Kona today, and the number changes every day, but there's probably about 600 coffee farms in the Kona Coffee Belt. And so we try to represent that time period back in the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, when the coffee pioneers were just getting this Kona coffee industry started. As we walk down that pathway, we like to try to give people that feeling that they're stepping back in time to the 1920s and 1930s. And the structures here, both of them are on the state and national registers of historic places. The house is from 1925, and the mill here is from 1926. And so the rest of the farm is set up just as you would have seen it probably back in that early 1900s time period. So I'm going to send you guys down the hill here. This is Ryan. He's just picking some of our coffee. Ryan will show you what we're doing with that picked coffee after it's picked. Someone like Charlie or us would haul that coffee down to this building so it could be processed. So let's walk on down there and have Ryan. You see the stuff we have going on inside the mill, some machinery. Yeah, the engine still runs. It's a 1926 John Deere engine. So it still runs. It could power this equipment. But most of our coffee that we pick that comes off these trees gets sent down the road to one of the co-op mills to be processed. So we sell our coffee. It's a co-op coffee, but we sell the coffee here at the kiosk.
And this is the true classic Kona coffee.
This is the true classic Kona coffee.
And what makes Kona coffee so special?
Lots of different factors. You've got a very unique climate, elevation here, and then you've got a special group of people that help make Kona coffee possible.
And I imagine terroir, the soils would be...
Yep. It's a very different soil nutrient content that is different from other parts of the world that are also growing coffee. And that contributes to the distinctive flavor. Ryan, you want to show them the processing mill?
Yeah. Welcome to the farm. Does anyone want to try process some coffee? Pulp some coffee? So this is the freshly picked coffee cherry. I'm going to put some down here and you can watch how it's pulped. Yep, keep turning it. Works as a mechanical squisher. So as the cherry is put under the pulper, the rolling part will roll over the bean, and the two halves of the bean inside of the skin are split apart. And that takes the skin off instantly. And how it's supposed to work is that the skin goes out the back, beans instantly come down the front. And this particular inside of the bean is the fruit of the coffee. It's a slimy, slippery kind of membrane. And if I sucked on it, it's sweet, like candy. It has a lot of sugars in it. And so what we'll have is a bucket here. We'll fill up the bucket with water, and it will catch all of these pieces of bean that have the fruit on them. And they'll basically soak overnight and ferment. And this is called the wet method of Kona coffee, where this layer of fruit is fermented off overnight. In other parts of the world, like in South America, they'll take this part with the fruit and take it straight to drying. And it doesn't taste quite as good if you do it like that, although it is easier because it saves a step, the extra step of going through the wet method of soaking does add a little bit to the flavor, making it a little bit smoother, which is what a lot of people say is gives Kona coffee its signature flavor. So this pulper was used from 1913 to 1926. The Uchida family came here in 1913, and it was used for 13 years, not because the technology wasn't available, but because the family couldn't afford it. They couldn't afford to buy an engine. So for 13 years, they did this by hand, and the routine would be picking cherry all day long, and then they would pulp it at the end of the day, because this kind of cherry, when picked off the tree, will start to rot in a couple of days, so it's best to pulp it, process it that night. And so they saved up enough money, built a mill in 1926, got an engine, and put the same model of pulper upstairs, you can see where the belt attaches to the side, rotated it by machine. So we can have a look and see what's inside of the mill. And by the way, these cans are what the children would use to pick coffee. They'd wear them around their neck like this, follow the family out into any, pick up any beans off of low branches or off of the ground. And what I love to say is that these little tin cans make a sound so the parents would know if their kids are working or not. They didn't hear anything out there, kids were all in big trouble. This is the size of a 100-pound bag, burlap bag of coffee cherry. And the donkey would carry 4 or 5 bags of these down the trail, drop them off at the foot of the mill. And the farmer would get the bag, dump all the contents, the ripe coffee cherry. The beans would then be spit into a fermentation tank. All the while, they're adding water. So the water is lubricating the pulper, making sure beans don't get stuck. And it will drip in and fill up the tank. And the beans will sit overnight. What's convenient also about soaking the beans is that the good beans will sink to the bottom, the bad ones float to the top. And that's because the bad ones may be bug-eaten, or they may be malnourished, or they didn't form and develop properly. So you skim the floaters, let the sinker sit overnight. The next morning, the farmer gets his sifter, sifts out the beans, saves all the water, dumps the beans out the window onto the ramp that connects down to the drying platform. So the ramp connects to the engine, so it will shake the ramp. The beans will trickle down the ramp and be dispersed on the hoshidana, or drying platform. So let's go and have a look at how that works. This was used to dry rice in Japan. They brought the same model over. It's simple in principle. If it rains, like it may about to in a few hours, no problem.
Hey, my name is Esuko. Arigatou gozaimasu. This house, Uchida Daisaku's family's house, built 1925. And three generations live here until 1994. Mm. Ori-san's wife was cooking here, making fire, until 1994. Can you believe it? You know, Ori-san's wife was still finding Oahu. You know, 101 years old.
Wow.
Yes. Hi. Yeah, I was cooking this morning. I wish I could show you how I was doing, you know. So no electricity, right? Mm-hmm. So how to cook. We had to make fire. So I was making fire and cooking here.
I'm Ryan Nakare.
How did you get involved in the coffee plantation?
You know, it's interesting. I went off to college in California, Oregon. I studied yoga and yoga therapy. Wow. And I came back to Hawaii last year. Spent a year doing different jobs. I picked coffee for the first time in my life, and I realized I didn't know anything about coffee farming or anything, even though I grew up here, and of course, Kona coffee is such a big part of the tradition here.
Did you pick coffee as a job?
Yeah, I did. I picked, the first day I worked for 6 hours, worked my butt off and made $37. And I said, this is not as easy as I thought it would be. And I went to Estonia in Eastern Europe for a couple of months.
Oh, nice. Why did you go there and what did you do?
I worked in an alternative school there for a while, just for 2 months. I taught different subjects to children. People would help me translate to the kids and stuff. And when I came back to Kona in December of 2014, I had a really big longing to try to reconnect with my roots and understand that became important to me for the first time in my life. Lo and behold, I saw an advertisement in the paper for the Kona Historical Society as an interpreter on the farm, and that really sparked my interest. So I applied for the job, I got it, started out part-time, then moved to full-time, and doing a variety of things here, working at the kiosk, helping in the gardens, being the farmer and interpreter. And it's been a real nice experience.
Tell us about some of the coolest things that you've learned since you've been.
Content-wise, of course, a lot of knowledge about coffee farming, about agriculture, about history, about Japanese and Hawaiian history, about immigration, and that became an important part of the way I look at the world now, is an interest in people's history, of their family history, where they came from, how they got to where we are. It gave me an appreciation for the hard work that our ancestors put in to pave the way for us to have an easier life today.
So would you say that the Japanese Nisei Issei were some of the primary farmers of coffee on the Big Island?
Absolutely. Back in the day, it was about 90% Japanese owned. Nowadays, not so much.
Okay. But so back in the day, do you think it was the Japanese that first kind of got it and decided to create an opportunity?
You know, I think the Japanese had the perseverance to really stick with it. Mm-hmm. And coming from the sugarcane plantations in Oahu, that was a much harder job.
This seemed a lot easier.
This was a lot easier. It was an opportunity to move up or eventually own your own property and make a name for yourself. And yeah.
So again, around 1900 or so, the first Japanese farmers started the coffee. Is that what it dates
from? Exactly, yeah, in the early 1900s, moving from Oahu to Kona.
Okay. On the Big Island, were there some Japanese that came directly from Japan to here? that didn't do the food chain from Oahu and work their way over here?
That's a good question. I mean, I assume there probably were a few, but most of them were from Oahu. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Today, the Japanese culture is still very strong and intact on the Big Island.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that not as strong as it used to be, sure. But relative to other things, very much so. You know, we have, like, people doing bone dances at temples. I live actually at a Buddhist temple.
Oh, do you?
Dai Fubiji's old mission in Honalo next to Tsushima's.
So you know, you follow Buddhist tradition?
My mom is a minister, so I've been inspired by the Buddhist tradition. I wouldn't describe myself as a Buddhist, but...
Okay. But there are certain aspects of Buddhism that obviously sing in your heart. What are some of the elements of Buddhism that permeate you, who you are?
I think just the emphasis on compassion, you know, being a loving and kind person, but also the meditative insights that Buddhism brings is a very practical religion. Like the teachings are very applicable to daily life and very psychologically oriented.
That's what I was going to ask. I was thinking as you're talking, I bet you that you employ some of those elements in your daily work and in keeping you centered.
Absolutely. Keeping you centered, absolutely. Yeah.
Your name once again?
Ryan Nakare.
Ryan, what a pleasure to meet you.
You as well. Yeah, yeah, thank you so much. Really a pleasure to talk to you.
I know. You too. Yeah. Cool. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Kona Historical Society's Kona Coffee Living History Farm, the Big Island of Hawaii.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing elephant sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.